Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 873. This is from Talking with Chris Hardwick episode with Jordan Peele, who was an incredible guest and has, I'm going to say, almost single-handedly changed the way films are going to be, like this genre of films are going to be made from here on out. But what an incredible achievement. I mean, between Key and Peele and now Get Out, I adore this man. And he's, I'm jealous of his incredible talent. Have you ever wanted to direct anything, Will?
I have, and I've always been afraid to.
TV's Will Wheaton.
I would never want to direct that guy because he wants to direct.
Yeah.
And they're the worst. yeah, actually I have. Because one of my problems as an actor is that I tend to get a little cerebral and overly analytical about things. As I think about how this is all going to like work together as a whole piece, that's great as a director, but it can inhibit a performance as an actor.
Well, I think Jordan would tell you you should use those analytical skills and direct, because we talk about that very thing in this episode. Get Out is currently available on digital download and will be available on Blu-ray and DVD May 23rd. It's so great. And he actually talks about some alternate endings in this conversation.
Oh.
Some stuff he didn't shoot and then some stuff that they did shoot. So here we go. Talking with Chris Hardwick is on Sunday nights on AMC at 11 o'clock. Our next guest is the cast of Orange is the New Black.
Get Out!
Fantastic. Yeah, they were all wonderful. So here we go. Nerds Podcast number 873. Katie. I see what you did there, by the way.
Yeah, by the way, thank you.
I didn't want to acknowledge. I know. I rolled past it pretty quickly.
Because it was pretty good.
It was pretty slick.
Yeah.
Katie, roll that thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Tonight, my guest has smashed cinematic records with his groundbreaking horror thriller comedy Get Out. Not only was it a huge box office hit, but it was critically acclaimed, getting 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is damn near impossible. The film marked his directorial debut, and if that wasn't enough of an accomplishment, he also wrote and produced it. We're going to talk about what it's been like since Get Out has become the most talked about film of the year, his hugely popular sketch comedy series Key and Peele that he created with Keegan-Michael Key, his background in improv, as well as his passions and his insights. It is my absolute pleasure to say that tonight, Jordan Peele will be talking with Chris Hardwick. We have heard you on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook using @talking. I'll read your questions, comments, Clements, that you sent to using a hashtag talking hard. We're going to see some video messages up here. People in the studio audience are going to ask questions. I'm going to give them things.
You're specific Jordan Peele fans.
Yeah. Yeah. You have fans. And I am so delighted and honored that you came to do the show because you were on the Nerdist podcast, literally I think you left the podcast to go to the premiere of Get Out.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. And then, I mean, that was the day that my life changed.
It really
great.
Did.
Yeah.
It really did.
I love talking to you about
it. Oh, thank
you. That was like one of my favorite interviews I got to do because I got to nerd out. I mean, it was awesome.
Well, also because, I mean, you really did invent a genre. And you were talking about it on the podcast when you said, you know, I loved this idea of a social thriller.
Yeah.
And then Get Out is made, I don't know, like $150 million or something crazy, some insane number like that?
Some insane number, yeah.
Is it more than that?
You know, it's all in my bank account.
You don't even...
last time, so I'll check in my week. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's. I think that's very nice. I'm very strategic to like sort of coin the phrase social thriller for Get Out because, you know, it's like, you know, I realized I wasn't really a horror, wasn't really a psychological thriller, and so that was kind of what it was. But to be honest, there's been many, so you know, Stepford Wives and Rosemary's Baby sure. I talk about all the time. You know, they have that same quality where, you know, humanity itself is the villain.
Right.
So I did coin the term, but I don't think I made the first social thriller. And in fact, I would say that all the thrillers, all the horror movies that really hit and strike some kind of chord are appealing to us on some social level.
But I think that's what's so, you know, interesting and also a bummer for humanity is how much this tapped into something that involves race relations and the way people communicate and the way they exist in America today. So it is sort of a hooray. Oh, that's too bad. That's, you know, bad. It's like it's kind of a bummer at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the hard part of doing it is that doing the movie the way I did it, where I'm diving straight into this very difficult topic to discuss. Right, race is kind of a conversation killer in a lot of situations,
sure.
And that was kind of the problem I was looking to address. Like, that, why don't we have this expressed in a horror movie, in a modern horror movie? I think the difficult thing is when you make a movie that's hitting it right out the gate, and the audience knows they're going to see something about race, that can go well or that can go bad.
Sure,
you know, people can feel like, I don't want to get preached at.
Right.
Whereas if you do a movie about UFOs and it sort of subconsciously taps to on our fears of invaders from a different land.
Right.
Then you have a little bit of a smoother end.
We're going to build a wall. Build a wall in space.
We're going to build a space wall.
Build a space wall. We're going to make the Martians pay for it. Whoa, hey, come on. Take it easy.
That's right.
But you've seen the movie with a bunch of different audiences, and so do different demographics react to the film in different ways, or is it sort of, do they respond uniformly?
Well, first of all, like, nothing is better than getting to watch an audience experience the film.
Right.
It's just the most exhilarating feeling, satisfying thing to me. And what I find is, you know, the most interesting to me is mixed audiences. So, you know, like half white, half Black or minority, because you know we deal with these sort of microaggressions in the movie, and this idea of, you know, like, you know, Chris, the main character of the movie, at a certain point he's at this party, and you have he's surrounded by, you know, the grandfather's all friends, all a bunch of old white people basically, and you know, everybody, the first thing they want to say to him is their connection with his blackness,
right?
You know, so it's this you know, hey, you know I love Tiger. I love Tiger Woods, and so you know, those moments right there, that party, is very fascinating to watch. Black people I think have this feeling where that's something that's happened to us,
right?
And that feeling of isolation is very familiar. And I think that from the white side of the crowd, there's a recognition too, but maybe more of a, oh, have I done that?
Well, also, because I think some white people approach black people like every black, like all black people work for the same company.
I think the line is, if you're a white person, if you see a black person, if the first thing that wants to come out of your mouth is something about black culture,
right,
maybe you should back away.
And also, if it is the first thing that comes out of your mouth, cut your losses. Don't try to make it better.
Make it better. You've already lost. Walk away.
I'm just saying, two of my friends. Okay, I should leave. Right. Yeah, yeah.
But it's not a thing. You know, I would say it's not the type of thing where you can't talk about black culture with a black person. It's not that.
Right.
And what I try to show with the movie is that, you know, part of the black identity, well, or at least mine, is, you know, the feeling like, You get in that situation over and over again, it adds up. And it adds up to this feeling that I'm more my race than I am a person.
Right.
In a way, right? So anyway, it's amazing watching the audiences experience that together. But I also feel like by the end of the film, any crowd I've seen is totally on the same page.
And this idea of identity you bring up is interesting because you're mixed race. And so is Keegan, actually.
Yeah.
And so how do you want to get these messages out in a way that you feel like fairly represents all sides?
But, I mean, this is the question of my life. You know, this what does identity mean? I definitely identify as a black man, but I have a white mother. And so growing up with that, in that sort of in-between place, in some ways makes you feel connected to the different sides of your culture, different American identities.
Yeah.
In a different way, it makes you feel sort of like the outsider of being anyone. But certainly, as far as my identity, as far as anyone's concerned in this country, I'm a black man walking down the street.
How much of Get Out was intentional, and how much did you, when you were making it, it just sort of accidentally happened? You're like, oh my gosh, wow, I guess I really did have this bit of a story to tell, and I didn't even realize it at the time.
You know, I was working on the story for so long. I worked on it for about 5 years before I even started writing the script. And about halfway through coming up with it, I sort of realized where these images and these ideas were coming from, and it was this racial fear. And I specifically sort of found this connection with the prison industrial system and modern, you know, modern day slavery, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I had a moment where I was having fun writing the script. I had to stop and cry because I was literally thinking about, you know, the black men and women that are tossed into jail for most of their lives for maybe, you know, holding less weed than I was smoking when I wrote the movie.
Right, right, right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And so that was a very profound moment when I didn't set out to talk about that, but halfway through coming up with the whole thing, I realized that's what this movie needed to be about, was this sort of complacent abduction of black men.
Did you ever worry, like, oh, this is, I don't want to not be respectful of what I'm trying to say, so how do I express this idea in a way that doesn't bum anyone out and miss the mark?
Exactly. I mean, that was the whole thing. And the whole reason I recognized early, I was like, all right, let's do this. Let's make a horror movie about race. And recognizing the problem is, if it's too funny, if it's too silly, you're not doing justice to the seriousness of the issue.
Right.
If it's too serious, it's a total bummer. No one wants to go to the theater just to see racial violence or torture. So it has to strike this tone. It has to somehow still be fun. The notions of, you know, these sort of symbols of white world being sort of villainous, I knew that was kind of funny.
Right.
I know, you know, Jeremy holding a lacrosse stick is like, there's a reference there that's like, oh my God, right? It's like, it's funny. It's good. But then I also know we had this character, you know, Rod.
Right.
He's saying what we would say if we were in that situation.
He's
using his human, his black perceptiveness, his TSA Spidey sense.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that there's, ultimately, I think that because I play everything, I take those sort of comedic notions, and we played everything as real as possible. It's like, okay, we've got this, I mean, when you think about it, totally over-the-top B-movie premise. So let's try and make, what if this was real? And that's how we sort of tried to strike the tone.
But even from a directing standpoint, Rod was perfect because he's basically never in the action. Like, he's separate.
Right.
So you have the story, you have Chris's story going on in this one area, mm-hmm. and then you cut away, and it's like, it's almost like a Greek play where it's like the guy's doing the asides to the audience, mm-hmm. like, and now this is going to happen, you know.
He's the observer. So
right.
So he's, Rod is kind of us. But yeah, he becomes more of the part of the plot than we originally realized he's going to be. And for that, I was very, I was into that, you know, the Stephen King-ish moments. So the hollering from The Shining, Scatman Crothers character.
Yes, yes.
Right? Who all of a sudden becomes the guy who, ooh, there's a hope in this ally we've made early on. And then also the sheriff from Misery. Right?
Oh, right. Yeah, that guy. Yeah.
Both characters who get killed, you know, but there's this second wave of intrigue and like this you know, when all hope is lost, there's this hope that, hey, maybe our old ally from the beginning is gonna come save the day.
We just have to take a quick break. More with Jordan Peele when we come back on Talking. We are back with Jordan Peele. By the way, congratulations. Get Out is the first debut film by a black filmmaker to reach over $100 million at the box office. Crazy accomplishment.
Hard to be proud.
I know what you're saying. It's hard to be proud in 2017. It's like, yeah. Why didn't this happen before?
Hard to be proud to be the first. But I'm just thrilled people are getting the movie and that it is... It's starting conversation, you know?
Good. Now, are you going to develop more films that have a social message, social thriller, or was this just sort of, like, oh, this is this, but I'm going to go do something else differently now? Because what I wonder is, you know, listen, Hollywood responds to money, and this has made a lot of money. And so are you concerned that other people are going to set out to make social thrillers? I just feel like there's a fine line between social thriller and exploitation.
I'll tell you, I mean, it is hard to do. It is hard to find that line. So, but I love the idea of inspiring more work, you know, less on the studio level, more on the artist level. But it's tough to needle that thread. The beauty of horror and comedy as well, to me, as art forms to deal with social messages, is that there's a built-in sort of contract with the audience and the filmmaker that with those genres, I might cross the line a little bit.
Right.
There's an irreverence that's expected. You know, I always say, like, the biggest R-rated horror movie of all time is The Exorcist. And, I mean, people saw this movie, and it's a cherished, and, you know, there's some scenes in that movie that are just not okay. Like, you can't be a wholesome American and be like, yeah, Exorcist is scary. Like, no, yeah. you can't do that. So it just kind of goes to show you with that genre, you can cross the line, which I think allows you to deal with difficult issues. Something like race is usually a conversation that once somebody crosses that line, it's the conversation has to stop. You know what I mean? It's
right.
Like, it's too uncomfortable. It's too much. There's too, nobody wants to have that conversation. But if you do it in horror, then the audience is there because it's fun.
You have the barrier. You have the barrier of, you know, there's the barrier of, oh, it's not real. It's a horror. It's not, or it's comedy. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be, you know, you can.
That's right. This person made this movie for me. I went into the movie knowing it was meant to horrify me. So I'm already part of this conversation. And if it's effective, you know, that's what, you know, Keegan and I always felt like with comedy. It's you can talk about anything if you get the laugh.
Right.
If you don't get the laugh, you shouldn't have gone there.
Well, that's part of the tightrope act of comedy, too, is like, can you make this funny? And if you make it funny, I mean, just look at, like, what South Park gets away with is so blows me away.
Yeah.
And then I kind of wonder, part of it is probably like, well, it's South Park. They've been, you know, they were sort of grandfathered in a pre-social media era. You know, I feel like if South Park started now, there would be social media campaigns, you know, and against it. Mm-hmm. And but it's like, oh, that's South Park. But also, you know, they do write. I mean, like, a lot of stuff in the show is still funny, you know,
yeah.
And they do get away with stuff because it's funny. And it doesn't just seem like they're trying to make. I think there's some of it's in the motivation, too. Are you just saying stuff to shock people and get a reaction? Or is there a real statement behind the comedy?
Right. They have, I mean, they do some of the best social satire ever, right? They just know humanity and what's wrong with us so
right.
Well. You know, I think in the beginning it was like this idea that, oh, because they're cartoons and they're cute, they can get away with foul
language.
It's
another layer of separation.
But the, you know, as they've gone on, like you said, it's... There's this understanding that they're kind of untouchable in a way. Like they don't care what you think.
Right.
And we know that, so they can kind of do it. There's something about being unapologetic and also consistent. Like, they get everybody.
Right, right. It's across the board.
That's right.
But I worry that there's no... people aren't interested in conversations anymore. I worry that what social media is slowly doing to us, and I owe, I think, pretty much my whole career to social media, but I think what it's slowly doing to us is eroding our ability to have meaningful conversations, because it's so much about getting attention and so much about getting likes and so much about that people just shout at each other. Mm-hmm. And there's no, and you realize, oh, I don't think anyone really cares about conversation. I mean, not anyone, but I don't think a lot of people really care about understanding and compassion and conversation. They're just frustrated and they just want to be heard. So people are just shouting at each other back and forth, and there's no one ever steps back and says, well, wait a minute, what if we really tried to understand one another?
Yeah.
So how do you recommend that people actually, and I know this is a dumb, sounds like a dumb question, maybe it is, but how do people really have conversations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and like the internet, the internet's a monster, but it's also it's crazy because it's, you know, in some ways it's this huge technological thing like television. It's brought us closer. It's made the world smaller in a way. So you have to acknowledge the good that it brings. Like, we live in a world where now, like, somebody could go home right now and fall in love with their bride in Australia.
Right.
You know what I mean? So there is bringing people together, but there's also like bringing together of people that kind of should be apart.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's like that's where the hatred comes. Like, we're closer to our enemies too.
Yeah.
And then when you add the factor of the anonymity, the mask of the internet, that's when people's demons really start coming out.
It is. I keep saying, yes, free speech is a right. Anonymous speech is a privilege. And because so many people, it's just my feeling, because I feel like so many people, and there are times where being able to be anonymous is vital to someone, especially if there are human rights violations or if they're legitimately in danger. But I feel like so many people weaponize anonymity online that it just... It's like, you're fucking ruining it for the good people. Come on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's kind of like a Wild West frontier, right? The regulations, the laws.
It's Deadwood. The internet's Deadwood. Yeah.
And the dudes running around Deadwood with Jason masks are like the dudes you don't want to talk to.
Right.
You
know, they're just chaotic evil.
Chaotic evil.
Yeah, they just want to slash and burn no matter what.
Yeah, they're the Joker.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, we have this to deal with now, and feels like one of those guys is the president.
Do you...
It's true. I think he would even agree at a certain point.
Yeah, I'm surprised the swearing-in music wasn't just...
Yeah, that's a good bit. Someone can and is about to cut that together.
They're going to cut together. Yeah, and our national anthem should just be an air horn. But do you feel a greater sense of responsibility now? Because you've become, Jordan was just placed into Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. Congratulations. 100 absolutely deserved. But do you feel pressure like, oh, do I have to be the voice of a generation now? Or do you want to be that? Or, you know, nurturing other people and helping them with their projects. Like, do you feel the weight of that responsibility now?
Yeah, I do feel it. You know, part of the strangest thing with all of this is that, you know, I made a movie that had my intent was mischief in a way. You know, my intent was to make something that was not okay.
Right.
And that would kind of provoke response, and that something that was irreverent, that sort of crossed that line in order to talk about it. And so now I feel like part certain images in this movie have become greater than me or the movie. Like the sunken place.
Right.
Right? I feel like there's this deep resonance with the black community, especially with this idea that this place is a psychological manifestation that is imprisons us and keeps our voices from being heard. and our opinions expressed. And so I realized, you know, for some people that, you know, I remember seeing a tweet somewhere where somebody was like, hey, I want to do a parody of Get Out. And someone else jumped on them and was like, hey, the work that Jordan Peele did was, you know, that was to be respected.
Right.
You know, you don't do, you know, and I'm like Key and Peele, like 2-3 years ago, I was doing like Puppy Dog Iced Tea, you know. Like, so, but it's hard for me to make that transition. Like, oh, you know what? It's like this movie is about fun, but for some people, some of the ideas in here aren't laughing matters.
Right.
And it's I'm in awe of this watching this project kind of influence other artists and thing like that. So yeah, my goal is to kind of is to continue to make stories, to continue to push representation of, you know, all the untapped voices and faces the best I can.
You said something that I thought was very powerful, where you said, well, there are certain stories that only Black people can tell. There are certain stories that only Black directors can tell.
And you know, I realized this was the case while making this movie and while writing this movie. Halfway through writing it was my eureka moment that I was the only person who could direct it. But I think part of what was holding me back from even thinking it was a makeable film was feeling like Hollywood is white, and that most people don't know who directs movies and whatnot.
Right.
So, you know, when you watch a movie, you're not thinking about the director. So I felt like, look, if my movie comes out and people watching it and presume, because it's Hollywood, they presume it's a white director, this movie has a completely different vibe to it, right? You know, can you trust this movie? And I think that's why I became an important part of the story of bringing this movie out. In a way, is to say, well, look, this is what happens when, you know, Hollywood gives a Black director a chance at making a horror movie about race.
Right.
But yeah, it's very interesting because there were moments that party scene. I felt like that party scene. You have to have been there to direct that.
And also, everyone in the movie is fantastic too. By the way, like all the performances are phenomenal.
This is why I love directing, is because I can, you know, if I'm acting in something, I'm like, you know, it's like hearing your own voice, and it's like, no, please, God, no. You can hate, you can't quite bring yourself to enjoy it as an audience. Directing this movie, I get to watch these actors perform, and I really just truly feel like each one of them is a masterpiece.
Because of you know, your background in improv and sketch and Key and Peele, was anyone surprised that you didn't want to be in the movie?
I don't think surprised. You know, there was a lot of people who asked, and I think there was some interest early on, but it was people who couldn't quite wrap their head around the tone I was going for.
Right.
And I thought that, you know, if I'm in it, it's like, oh, okay, so this is his scary movie, you know.
Right.
What I mean, and which you know, I love scary movies, so don't get me wrong. But this, you know, I didn't want to give people the idea this was a Key and Peele flavored movie, because it's so it has its own thing going on. And then I'm not that big a fan of myself.
Really?
Well, I mean, look. I mean, the two roles I could have conceivably played would have been Chris and Rod.
Right.
And I mean, look at the dudes that I got to play Chris and Ron.
Right.
I mean, it's a different level.
Directing to me scares the shit out of me.
And I want you to direct.
But I know you do, and I don't know why.
Well, because look, I mean, the way you consume things, it's all like, it's a matter, you know, Bradley Whitford said it to me once. He was like, you know, directing is, it's taste. It's all taste. But if you have the good taste, I know that's your fear that you're going to make the wrong choice.
Of course it is.
Like, but the fact that you scrutinize these, you would put the right scrutiny on it, and then you would rely on the advice of the people around you.
Well, I know, but so before, when I went and said hi to Jordan in the dressing room, we kind of got off on I got us onto a tangent about Ghostbusters, and there's typical.
As you,
and there's a. There were some cut scenes on the Ghostbusters DVD from just stuff that was cut out. And if you know the movie Back to Front, as I do, it was interesting to see. But they did this thing where Aykroyd and Bill Murray were like that SNL thing where you have SNL people on, they're going to do characters in the thing. So they play these two guys, and I think they might have been like homeless guys or just old guys walking through Central Park or something. And I watched that scene. I was like, holy shit, I am glad they cut this out. Yeah. It's not good.
It's not good.
And so I think about that, and I think, you're Ivan Reitman. You have two of the biggest comedy stars in your movie, and you're about to cut out a scene where they're, you know, doing... How do you know to do that? Like, it just... There are a million wrong ways to present a movie, and, like, maybe one or two right ways to present a movie.
But you know what? You had, in your instinct, you had the right answer.
But I just said, I know that's bad. I didn't say...
that's all you need.
Yeah,
that's
I don't
all
know.
You need as a director. I know that's bad. I know that's bad. I know that's bad. I know that's bad.
Was it... But, I mean, this was your first movie, so how did you handle it as a director? Was there a lot of...
A lot of emotional support from my wife. It was such a difficult. Everything is coming at you. So many decisions, so many choices, problems arise, and it was so fun, and it was so fun to be in that zone. But by the middle of the process, at the end, I would be like, baby, I want to come home. it was nuts. But you ask people. You don't be afraid to ask people's opinion. What do you think of this? Right. Whether you like this one or this one?
And you don't think they're going to go, you're the director, you're supposed to know.
Yeah, well, yes, if they do that, you move to the next person.
Oh, gotcha.
Well, what do you think then? and it's old-timey. When you direct, it's all...
So you wore the pants and the big bullhorn.
And all right, and go.
Places, everybody.
I had a little, cigar, a little monocle.
You, Joan Crawford! Joan!
Where is she?
Where's Joan Crawford? But no. Did you, as a sketch performer, because I'm always fascinated by the way that stand-up and sketch improv people diverge, because I feel like we are all definitely from the same magical pool, and that pool is dirty, broken water. But but I toyed with sketch and improv in the beginning, and then I realized, I don't like being other people. I just like being me. But then I find... Well, sketch people really don't like doing stand-up for the most part because they like being in character.
Yeah.
So are you comfortable being yourself as a director, or did you come on like and play the role of it? Like, did you have a character, like the role of a character?
Sort of brilliant the way you broke it down. It's that, I went into sketch and improv, I think because I was unclear what I could offer the world that would be understood or accepted by them. So being in character was much more comfortable for me. By the time I made this move, and Key and Peele was actually huge. Like I started doing stand up for the first time in preparation for Key and Peele, just to see what's my identity? If the show has my name on it, what am I talking about?
Right.
And then that that kind of helped inform the show and evolve me helped me evolve as an artist. By the time I was directing this movie, I feel like I was just very clear with the vision of the movie. So I just knew I had to facilitate that thing. To me, the way to direct is to have fun with people and to help them have fun. So. I try and use my comedy to get laughs during the thing. Like, while I'm directing, I direct as Obama. Time, are we ready? Maybe I'll listen to Obama. You're going to listen to Jordan.
This, like, breaks the tension for the
breaks
people.
You get, like, a two laugh. You get a little murmur, which is, like, 5 p.m. on a Thursday is, like, needed juice, I think.
Yeah, but then you get to that crucial point where you're like, all right, it's going okay. Do I pull out now or double down on it?
Yeah, I mean, it becomes like it became like a little bit of these little mini sets you get to do. But yeah, it's keep it fun.
Yeah.
I'm not about having a set where there's drama or tension or anger or disrespect. The whole thing, everybody should be gets rid of their ego for this idea.
Well, I feel like that's going to be easier for you now, especially because now that you've made this movie, I feel like people are really going to come in now and go, oh. I mean, you might be in a weird situation where you just go, hey, yeah, I'm just Jordan.
Yeah, well.
You know? Hey, just chill out. Everything's fine.
It is weird. You kind of want to replicate the conditions of the first one because it did, the balance of it kind of worked. It's going
to
be.
Well, there's going to be a reverence that you might not be entirely comfortable with. Because you may not feel that way about yourself. You know, it's like when people, especially if you're a comedian, you probably kind of hate yourself a little bit, you know? And there's stuff about yourself you're not happy about, and comedy is armor, and it's defensive, you know? And so, you know, now I think because of the importance of this film, both socially and also financially, I think, you know, you're going to have to get used to that a little bit or try to figure out how to, like, just, you know, like ground people a little bit around you.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You may be right. And one of the hard things to accept, but one of the most amazing things about this project is that there was no proof that this was going to work.
Right.
So everybody that did the project really took a leap of faith with me. And that was just like, that was incredibly meaningful because it's the type of thing. It's like, hey, you know, Brad, Catherine, you want to play this weird liberal elitist racist villain? You know, it's like
those words together.
You know, what do you think? Some ways that, I mean, there's so many ways that could ruin their career.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like there's ways the movie could work and it could ruin your career.
Right.
So to get that level of faith and trust from such talented established actors, is like pretty crazy.
We have to take a quick break. Yeah. When we come back, I want to talk about Key and Peele. I want to have audience members ask some questions of their own. We're going to hear from you guys also at home. If you want to be a part of the show, at Talking on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, you will find exclusive updates about upcoming guests. And you can ask any questions that you might have using the hashtag Talking Hardwick. We'll be right back with Jordan Peele. Welcome back to Talking with Chris Hardwick, my guest, Jordan Peele. Enough out of this mouth. Let's let someone from the audience ask a question. Get on up here.
Hi, my name's Jillian. I'm here from Atlanta.
Hello.
Hi. My question is, were you ever fearful that Get Out wouldn't be perceived well because of your reputation as a comedian?
You know, there was some of that. The fear was, are people going to presume it's something else? And how do you get people to understand what it is without showing them the movie? Which I think is still kind of the case. Like, there's not a lot to compare it to. So yeah, that was a fear, but I also knew that it would be a welcome change from my comedy because the fun is there, the comedy is there, and then there's some other things going on too.
Here, this is for
you.
That's for you. This one's for you. Let's see what the internet wants to know. It's S-D-O-T-K Hannah. I just saw Get Out, and OMG, Jordan Peele, you are brilliant. These are all caps. So many layers, so much symbolism, so deep. You're amazing. And then Mac KG Forever says, Get Out was amazing. Jordan Peele, you did an awesome job. Quesadilla Bad says, let's not forget about Get Out. Come Oscar season, Jordan Peele's direction and screenplay is amazing. I think it totally, you probably aren't even thinking about that sort of a thing. But I think it absolutely.
Oh, yeah, look, hey,
come on.
I mean, look, it's. I'm so living this moment here. It's. I couldn't even.
But if the Academy, I mean, if the idea is like, hey, let's celebrate fresh, innovative, important films, it's completely fresh, completely innovative, really. I mean, it's like it. Listen,
wow, thank
you're
you.
Hearing it here first.
Very nice of you. Very nice.
If it doesn't happen, forget I said this.
I will.
And then also, Lung Y on Twitter says, Get Out is amazing, balls to the wall from the word go, a perfect opening scene, great score and sound.
Yeah.
The score was phenomenal, too.
Amazing. I mean, Michael Abels is the composer, and he's a guy who hasn't done a film before. He's a real master of classical, jazz, tribal, a real eclectic guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I needed somebody who could put together a new sound. you know, I needed something that I knew the movie was new, a new idea, and the only way to tell it would be with this new sound. So he, you know, I asked him to put together something that felt like a haunted Negro spiritual.
Right.
You know, and or, you know, something decidedly black voices, definitely black voices, but with this this darkness that we don't hear typically in black music. And he nailed it.
Were the words saying anything? Was it saying anything?
Yeah, the whole Siki Lisa was kind of this, it was kind of an extension of the warning, right? Get out. Mm-hmm. You know, the warning that we scream at the screen when people don't do the smart thing. Get out. And so the warning is, you know, trust your ancestors, run, beware. It's sort of these warnings. And then, of course, we get into, Redbone of Childish Gambino,
right,
which sort of sums it all up in Stay Woke.
This is KNicole74 on Instagram. Is there an alternate ending to Get Out? If so, why did you feel the need for an alternate ending?
You don't feel the need for an alternate ending. It kind of happens. When the Blu-ray DVD comes out, you'll be very excited to know that there is another ending on there.
Interesting.
Yes, there's another ending. I don't know how much to give away. You know, some of it's out there. I will say it doesn't go as well in this ending. But I had written many endings. I'd written many versions of the scripts, many endings. And, the original one we shot, left people wanting something different.
It just didn't feel, without giving it away, I think
without
we can all kind of guess
what happened. You can all figure it out. But for me as well,
unsatisfied.
I was so excited when I was able to go get the money to go reshoot the ending that I knew would really work.
Yeah. Was there a really insane ending that you're like, well, I'm not even going to bother with this one, but well, it would be crazy if we did this. What was that?
Well, there was a very early one that ends with, it took place in a gated community, which I kind of pulled back from that. And but by the end, Rod comes to the break in the gated community, finds his way in. He's looking for Chris, and he sees Chris looking in a window on Main Street. And he goes, "Chris!" And Chris turns to him and goes, "I assure you, I don't know who you're talking about." Here's the thing, you know, part of making this movie, you know, at several stops, I realized something about myself, my identity as a filmmaker. And that is, you know, I think there's a lot of great artists that, you know, approach a movie like any kind of art. This is a piece of self-expression. If you get it, you get it. If you don't, that's your problem.
Right.
And I kind of respect those people. Like, that's badass.
Right.
But to me, you know, I think probably from my comedy background, I want to serve the audience. I want them to get paid back for what they've given me with their attention. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, what does the audience want?
Right.
At every turn, what does the audience want out of this movie? I don't want to disappoint them.
Yeah. Well, I think that's important because especially, I think that also comes from improv and sketch training where you realize, as a performer, you are forming a relationship with the audience. Mm-hmm. And it's like in life, you can, you know, it's fun to have compromises. Sometimes people come along and they're like, "I am how I am. Fuck you if you don't like it." And you go, "Wow, that person's really attractive." But if you spent more than a week with them, you go, "This is the fucking worst narcissist." You know, it's like it's not a...
That's right.
When it's just for them, it's not always as...
And I had always sort of thought, oh, man, that's what you have to be a director. You have to be like a singular vision and unwavering and uncompromising. It's not that at all. You have to compromise a lot. It's just you have to know what can't be compromised.
Right.
It was very exciting for me. You know, I knew I'm asking a lot of the audience. I'm asking you to come and sit in this movie that's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be tense at times. And it's going to discuss uncomfortable, you know, it's about race.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, do I want to go sit in a room and hear about race for 2 hours? Not really. But so if they're going to come, I have to reward them with entertainment.
We're going to take a quick break. More with Jordan Peele when we come back. Welcome back to Talking with Chris Hardwick. Tonight, Jordan Peele is talking with Chris Hardwick.
Me.
Can you please remind the audience what you went to school for?
So I majored in puppetry. So I was a chick magnet. Yeah. Yeah, puppetry is the major that basically screams, "I've got home problems." No, I look.
I will create the life I wish I had.
I was a visual artist first as a kid growing up. And then I found performing. I was at this musical theater group called Tada in New York for kids. That's really amazing, original shows. And so I got the acting bug, and I wanted to be a director by the time I was 13. By the time I went to school, I went to Sarah Lawrence College. And I went there because it looked awesome, and there was girls, and it's a liberal arts college. So right. I took that to mean, okay, I'm going to declare my major, which, puppetry. That's what I want to do. And by the way, they have a puppetry class. But by the second year, I had fallen in love with, you know, what I consider the best puppet, the one you're born with, right? Like, so this...
Your penis.
I did a puppetry of the penis tribute
what
show.
What time is it? It's such a strange... But, yeah, I know. You're basically saying, like, you are the puppet.
So I'm the puppet, right? So that was my thing. And then I left college to go to study improv and sketch in Chicago.
And which, you know, I think no matter what sort of comedy discipline you're into, it's good to... I think good direct... Because... Sketch and improv are all about teamwork, and stand-up is all about, you know, taking responsibility for everything. And that's why I think sketch and improv people are better at doing stand-up than stand-ups are at doing sketch and improv, because you really do have to understand how to work as a team, and you have to trust people, and you shouldn't railroad the scene, and that's what stand-ups do, you know? So
yeah, I mean, well, stand-ups, I definitely, and also with sketch and improv, I think it's a different type of personality. There's a safety in numbers, and there's a desire to collaborate there.
Right.
I know a lot of stand-ups, it seems a little more competitive a field.
Well, your wife is a stand-up.
My wife is a stand-up.
It's a great stand-up.
Fantastic stand-up. And Little Rel Howery is a stand-up. Mm-hmm. I think they're good examples of what a stand-up gets in training that sketch and improvisers don't, which is they know themselves, and they know their humor, they know who they are.
Right.
And so the performance that Rel does in Get Out, for example, as Rod, it's kind of the most, it's strangely the most realistic, character in a way. And you just believe this guy. He's being real. I mean, he probably has, less formal training than any of the other people. But he really connects because he knows his voice.
Right.
And he's so comfortable in his voice. And it's so cool for me to... especially as a director, to learn, figure out how to work with the different actors and different styles, because everybody's got a unique way of working.
Yeah. Did the sketch and improv training ever provide any real world application?
I don't know if this is real world, but there was this weird program that I made like a quick buck on, where there was this test that they would give to prospective principals of public schools in Chicago. And part of the test was that I, this improviser, local improviser, would come in and play either a kid or a teacher that they would have to, like, discipline or deal with. And then at the end of this, I would be like, I think Mr. Bugsy would make a good principal. Mr. Wilcott, not so much.
So it's kind of like a cross between 21 Jump Street and So You Think You Can Dance?
Yeah, and it was way too much power
for the
kid from Improv Olympic who pops over and is like, this, you know, essentially deciding the fate of the future. But it was, you know, it was like these little scenarios. Like I would, either I would be playing a teacher who had crossed the boundary or something. And
right.
This principal had to be like, well, you're going to have to be a relief to your duty. you're not welcome back. I don't know why he's like old Louisiana.
I don't know what
Chicagoan. But yeah, that was a weird one, and but fun. I mean, the improv to me is one of the great things. Like, anybody can benefit from taking improv class.
Yes.
Doesn't matter what you do, it is something that will, I think, enhances your life. If nothing more than the fact that it's fun.
Yeah, and I know you did improv in Amsterdam, right? The Boom Chicago, you did improv in Amsterdam. So what is Amsterdam improv like?
Well, it's, you know, so Boom Chicago is this amazing company that sort of operates like Second City style improv and sketch. Very much based on Amsterdam and they perform in English, obviously, because, you know, it turns out Amsterdam has mostly English speakers.
Am I saying it wrong?
Yeah, I know. I purposely made I said Amsterdam in an earlier interview.
And someone corrected you?
No, I just realized, you know what? I'm going to start going with Amsterdam.
Are you doing that just to f*** with people?
No, it's actually, that's how the Dutch present it. That's how the Dutch presents it.
Amsterdam.
Because I can't be like, yeah, I lived in Amsterdam for 3 years. Like, I think it was like a Holland newspaper or something I was talking to.
We say Holland.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Actually, that's actually kind of appropriate.
Hey, there you go.
It is the land of Ho.
I mean, it technically is. It was right there the whole time. What is the craziest thing that happened at Amsterdam?
Amsterdam.
All the Dutch tweets are going to come rolling in.
Start rolling in.
Yes.
This was kind of legendary. I mean, we were doing an improv game called The Dream.
Okay.
And, you know, The Dream is something you get on stage, you get a volunteer on stage, you ask them about their day, and then you do an improv game about, you know, their day. You start shows again. So Burt Reynolds is in the crowd. He's in the audience. Got him, man, Mr. Burt Reynolds, come on up. So he gets up and he's, you know, he's answering the questions. And at some point, some kind of rowdy British guy in like the back row. So he's going, hey, what about your hair, mate? You know, he's like, does it come off your head, mate?
Oh, no.
You know, this, and so like everyone's like, and Burt Reynolds just stops the show and he goes, who said that? You, come here. And the whole crowd's like, and we're like applauding, and the guy comes to stage, and the guy just totally comes to just red face. Burt Reynolds stands on stage and he goes, I'll give you the count of 10 for you to pull this wig off my head, as you called it. And if you don't, if you wait to the count of 10, I'm gonna knock you out. And but so, look, there's no real twist or ending to this. It was the crowd went crazy at that moment.
Was he serious about it?
You know, he was half working the crowd, but nobody, certainly the guy on stage was just like, it was just such a powerful moment. And it was like watching Burt Reynolds take this like thing that could have been humiliating and belittling and turned it in, just won the entire room. It's like, that's a showman.
And then Burt Reynolds beat the living shit. Burt Reynolds
took the guy outside.
Killed him with his bare hands.
Killed him with his bare hands. And the guy was buried with Burt Reynolds' wig. His hand.
He got the wig.
He got the wig.
I had to kill him. Before we go to break, you should know you can get the extended version of this interview as a Nerdist podcast. Go to amc.com/talking for bonus clips, exclusive content, links to the podcast for every one of our episodes. More with Jordan Peele in a moment. We'll be right back. Hello, we are back with Mr. Jordan Peele. Let's have the audience ask a couple questions if they want to. What is your name?
From Detroit, and my question is, if you could pick any Key and Peele skit to make into a movie, what would you pick?
You know, my wife always asked me for a Megan movie. Megan and Andre. So, you know, maybe that.
Cool. Excellent.
It's not gonna happen.
What do I have for you?
You get a little Jordan Peele signed paraphernalia. What do you think about that?
Yeah, how about that? Oh, this would be great. I'll let you pick. Which one?
The top.
Okay, there the top. Go. Here you go. Signed by Jordan Peele. All right, great.
That's an amazing artist that is... I don't know who it is.
We have a video message. Take a look.
Hi, I'm Doug from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and my question is, what was your favorite character to play or your favorite sketch from Key and Peele?
Favorite character to play? Oh, the Continental Breakfast guy.
Okay.
You know, Conrad. That's what we named him the second time. But yeah, it was. It's like this guy, this tramp character. He's the guy who goes to the Continental Breakfast, and he's like, Continental, you say? Okay. I like the sound of that. So all the continents. Each one. All five of them. Very nice. Not too shabby.
What was your writing process for that? I mean, because
it was this
yeah. right here. Because it is, and we talked a little bit about this when you're on the podcast, but, you know, you're doing the show, and you guys, I feel like you really did go out on top on that show. Right. Did it feel like, you know, if we're going to overstay our welcome, or like, we just don't, did you just get exhausted from the process? Because it seems like a pretty exhausting.
It's a little all of that. I think we would have known if we could have, if we had a better season in us. And I just think we, you know, it wasn't feeling like that. And,
right.
you know, for, you know, we both had, you know, he's an amazing dramatic actor. He's very interested in doing more of that.
Yeah.
I had this movie that, you know, I felt was, you know, is gonna, you know, was, that's where my passion was taking me. So it was just, you know, it was very easy for us, really. And it was great. It felt great to be able to do. You know, we had a lot of fans reach out and, you know, wanted us to stay. But, you know, I think we knew we had things that were pulling us.
Let's take a question from our audience. Get on up here and ask your question.
Hi, I'm Josh from Michigan. Who are your first comedic influences?
First comedic influence, I think Steve Martin, Martin Lawrence. The two Martins.
Together again.
Together. Actually, that would be the best movie right now. I would watch that.
Which Steve Martin album?
Well, for me, it was, you know, it was the movies. You know, it was
Jerk.
It was like Dirty, well, Jerk, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yep.
You know, Little Shop of Horrors.
Yep.
And then Martin was the show Martin, which is, you know, I think the kind of the best performance, the best sitcom performance of all time.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, directed by who?
Frank Oz.
Who was what? A puppeteer! Hey, come on.
It's Miss Piggy, that's right. And
there you go.
All right.
We have a video message, let's take a look.
Hi, my name is Lily from Edmonds, Washington, and my question is, what is the first movie you want to show your future child?
Oh, that is, because... Congratulations,
Thank
by
you.
The way, on the future child.
I think The Omen. Put it up by the crib. What could go wrong? Put it on repeat.
Kids love Damien.
You know, I'm excited for the day I can show my kid The Neverending Story.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I think Muppet Movie for me.
Muppet Movie broke my heart because of Sweetums.
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
Hey, guys, don't forget
for me. As we are letting you go, one thing that I like to ask people at the end of the show is just some bit of wisdom. I mean, you absolutely are an inspiration to people because I feel like, especially coming out of Key & Peele, I think there were so many different ways that you could have gone that were more comedy-based or more, you know, I'm going to be a comedic actor, but you... really made this thing that was very important to you, and you saw it through, and it absolutely paid off in every way possible. So, what, you know, what's a piece of wisdom that you would say to creators out there?
This is what I say to creators. The biggest thing that stops us from doing what we're doing is we don't follow the fun of it. Don't follow the practicality. Don't follow what's going to get this sold, what's going to make this good. If you're making a movie, you're writing your favorite movie that doesn't exist. And there's nothing more fun than that, if you think about it. If you think about going home, you get to imagine what's the movie you wish somebody would make for you. Follow the fun.
Excellent. Jordan Peele, I want to thank you so much. Get Out is available on digital right now. Blu-ray and DVD, May 23rd. And always check us out at Talking on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to find out who's going to be on the show, how you can be a part of it. We could not do the show without you, so thank you so much. I'm Chris Hardwick. At Hardwick on the tweets, the Instagram, the Facebook. Good night. Don't text and drive. Jordan Peele. Jordan Peele has been my guest.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Hey, listeners, it's Will Arnett. Our podcast, Smartless, has crossed a milestone that seemed unfathomable when we started nearly 4 years ago, as we've just released our 200th episode. Join us as we welcome the dynamic duo of hilarity, Steve Martin and Martin Short. You've seen them on screen together in The Three Amigos, Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and most recently, and only Murders in the Building. Both are comedic geniuses in their own right, but together they are always electric. And this episode of Smartless is no exception. I don't know if I've laughed more in a single episode than this one. We discuss their career arcs both separately and as a comedy team, how they met, who is more difficult to work with, and what motivates them today. Is Steve a better banjo player than Marty as a singer? Find out on this bicentennial episode of Smartless. Follow Smartless in the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you get to hear Sean cry. What a loser!